Welcome to Sleepy Time Travels. Fair warning here. If you have an aversion to historical truth, you might want to check out one of my other episodes, maybe one with fairy tales, instead of this true story of the events of the Tulsa disaster, which happens to be the title of this set of first-hand accounts written by Mary E. Jones Parrish, soon after the tragedy in 1921. This chapter of ugly American history has never been taught in Southern schools, at least not the ones I attended. My name is Russell Stamets. Some people like to fall asleep to the audiobooks I narrate. Most of these texts come from the treasure trove of dusty, forgotten books of the public domain. If you'd like to hear more of the audiobooks I sample on the podcast, or check out the rest of my catalog, search Russell Stamets on Audible or iTunes. I'll include links to the audiobooks and the Kindle and print editions in the episode description. If this is something you enjoy listening to, besides buying the books, you can support me by rating the podcast, following, or subscribing. Now, it's time to get comfortable, settle back, relax, and listen. Testimonials of the Tulsa Riot. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 20, 1921. The first information that I received of the riot came about 9:30 o'clock Tuesday night, May 31st, 1921. I was attending a play given by the senior class. A little boy came up, almost out of breath, and exclaimed, "They are trying to lynch a colored man downtown, and the colored people are going down to prevent it." The meeting broke up in some confusion, and all went home. We sat up at our house till about midnight, and then we decided to go to bed. There was little sleeping, for the noise of guns kept us awake all night. About 5 o'clock, a very peculiar whistle blew. This seemed to have been a signal for a concerted attack by the whites, for immediately a terrible gunfire began. Aeroplanes also began to fly over very low. What they were doing, I cannot say, for I was in my room. About 5:30, someone called up our home and said for the men set to fight for the home guard were visiting the homes and searching them, but that they would harm no one. A few minutes after that, some men appeared with drawn guns and ordered all men out of the house. I went out immediately. They ordered me to raise my hands, after which 3 or 4 men searched us. They told me to line up in the street. I requested them to let me get my hat and best shoes, but they refused and abusively ordered me to line up. They refused to let one of the men put on any kind of shoes. After lining up some 30 or 40 of us men, they ran us through the streets to Convention Hall, forcing us to keep our hands in the air all the while. While we were running, some of the ruffians would shoot at our heels and swore at those who had difficulty in keeping up. They actually drove a car into the bunch and knocked down 2 or 3 men. When we reached Convention Hall, we were searched again. There, people were herded in like cattle. The sick and wounded were dumped out in front of the building and remained without attention for hours. By James T. A. West, teacher in high school. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 21, 1921. Rumors came in and told me that the white people were burning the colored people's homes on Archer Street. Then I heard guns firing. This continued until early in the morning, when everyone ran away and left 2 other men and me. Later, the guards came, told one of the men to come out, but he replied, "I am shot." He then fell in my house, shot through the back. Then I came out of the house and tried to save something, but failed. My greatest loss was my beautiful home and my family Bible. I am 92 years of age, so they failed to bother me. I came up Easton to Frankfort Street, ran through the pipe yard, was nearly overcome by smoke, but was rescued and carried to Convention Hall. Mrs. Johnson, white, of St. Louis, took me to the Catholic Church. I remained there until about 2 o'clock, then was carried to the fairgrounds by the Red Cross, then brought back to the Methodist Church. a colored lady told me to come to her house and live. But when we got there, her home was in ashes. Mr. Williams, colored, then took me in charge, and I was afterwards taken over again by the Red Cross and kept out at the park. Then I was recommended to some white man who would take care of me. There had been some colored people to ask about me, one, a very dear friend of mine. As I have no children or relation, I had planned to will her my valuable property even before this happened, for she has treated me as a father. They did not let her take me, but as they have let me out to go to the white man, I think I shall go to her instead, as I would like for my property to fall to my own race. This is the worst scene that I have ever witnessed in my 92 years. Jack Thomas. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 22, 1921. On the night of the riot, we had our class of Bible study, as usual. After the class was over and far into the night, we heard shooting downtown, which we could only interpret to mean that there was trouble of some kind. We went into the house and went to bed listening to the spasmodic shooting, which clearly convinced us that there was trouble. In the morning, the shooting was more severe in front of our house. The whites were firing on colored, who, seemingly unaware of the trouble, were on their way to work, and in passing were met with volleys of shot. We remained in the house until some folks came and stated that, if we wanted protection, we had better go to Convention Hall at once. This we promptly did, leaving our house partly open. About 2 o'clock, we were called for by some white friends and brought back to our home to find every cube considerably tumbled around, but no serious damage. We found a white gentleman in charge of the house, who related to us that himself and son and a few neighboring white friends had prevented any further molestation of our home. They stated that they were ready to stay with us all night, if we thought it necessary, to ensure that we would not be molested. My principal loss was a 2-story brick building on Greenwood Street. Of course, we lost some clothes, shoes, money, and other things in the house that we did not consider worthwhile. As to preventing such mob violence, I refer you to my statements in the Oklahoma Sun, Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Black Dispatch, Oklahoma City, the Muskegee Sameter, Muskegee, Oklahoma. That is the best solution I know of for race riots and mob violence. Richard J. Hill, attorney, international Bible student. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 22, 1921. On Tuesday evening, about 9:30 o'clock, I heard the report that they were going to mob a colored boy, but my family and I remained at home. Then we heard firing. I ran for my daughter. Then a man and his family came running by, and he said, "The whites have burned my home and over $7,000. His wife had on about one piece. Then a crowd came and reported that they were burning and killing as they went, meaning the whites were killing and burning. I ran behind a cabinet, but they were crowding us so closely that I ran out to an outhouse where I began to pray. Then the crowd of whites ordered everybody to come out of the house. But they were slow about coming out, so the ruffians shot against the house. I ran further and saw about 15 white men chasing a man who was helpless. They even fired at him, but missed. I then went upon the hill carrying a small bundle of clothes and bedding. I was lost from my daughter and her baby until late in the afternoon Wednesday. I saw about 5 women faint. At the Presbyterian Church, I saw about 4 little children who were lost from their mothers. Old and young had to pile on trucks. And when we were being driven through town, men were seen clapping their hands, rejoicing over our condition. Mrs. Rose Adder Moore. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 22, 1921. Immediate cause. There was a report in the Tulsa Tribune that threats were being made to lynch a Negro for attempted criminal assault upon a white girl, which was wholly without foundation or cause. Second, white men reading this report gathered at the jail to take part in the lynching, and the Negroes, seeing this gathering, rightly concluded that lynching was the object of the white people, and consequently armed themselves and came to the scene and offered their support and assistance to the sheriff. While this was in progress, a fight between some whites and Negroes was started, which resulted in several members of each side being shot. The Negroes then left the courthouse and came to the east end, leaving a guard at every approach to the Negro quarter. Desultory firing on both sides was kept up for several hours, when the Negroes, believing all danger of an invasion by the whites over, went to their homes. But during this time, and unknown to them, plans for an armed invasion of the Negro quarter by the whites, under protection of the city and county police, had been underway. The avowed purpose of this invasion was to disarm the Negroes and to corral the men or arrest them, that they might not do any further harm. They, the whites, did this and in most cases met with no resistance, except in cases where reason was given by the whites for entering the Negro homes. And this was generally the rule. The Negro did not know whether he was being called out to be shot or what, for shooting was all he could hear or see. If he submitted without question, he was taken to jail. But if he dared to question the intruder, he was shot. After all the men had been corralled, the women and children were told to go to the public parks, where an armed guard would protect them, and that a guard would protect their homes. This ended the riot so far as the Negro had anything to do with it. Then came the great, unthinkable, unspeakable climax. The white people went into those homes just vacated, carried away everything of value, opened safes, destroyed all legal papers and documents, and set fire to the buildings to hide their crime. Then, not satisfied with the result, framed charges against every leading Negro in an attempt to jail them and to intimidate the others, saying that the whole fault lay with the educated Negroes. The fact that the educated Negroes have never caused trouble or friction, but there has been allowed to flourish a crowd of uneducated whites and Negroes who lived by their wits, and it is the intermingling of these whites with these Negroes that has always been the starting point of most of our trouble. By P. S. Thompson, Ph.C., Presbyterian Tulsa Medical, Dental, and Pharmaceutical Association. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 22, 1921. Causes: race prejudices and the national lack of confidence in law enforcement. This lack of confidence in law enforcement causes the Negro to feel that it is necessary to protect himself in most cases of threatened lynching. If the party is a member of our group, he is most generally lynched, even though promised the assurance of protection by law. And if of the other group, he is not lynched if given such protection. The lynchers often not only get the guilty parties, but wreak vengeance upon the innocent as well. Hence, the circulation of a report of lynching of members of our group is a signal to get ready for self-defense. It's like a spark in gasoline. It is generally uncontrollable and does not require leadership to mass its forces, but it often requires cool heads to prevent a conflagration and catastrophe. This was even employed in the Tulsa riot. First, the report of lynching, the signal to arms, the promise of protection, the rapid spreading of lawlessness, the cooler heads failing to act with sufficient alacrity to prevent the catastrophe. Shortly after daylight on Wednesday, June 1, 1921, I received a call to come to the hospital to dress two wounded men. I dressed hurriedly and started to the hospital. Just as I opened my front door, a shot was fired at me from a nearby hill. The bullet grazed my leg. I shut the door. A few minutes later, my wife, hearing the shots, slightly opened the door and a second volley was fired. At this time, the shots struck the porch. We shut the door and my wife said, "Doctor, let us go. Our lives are worth more than everything." I set my cases down in the hall and my wife and niece hurriedly dressed, locked the house and departed. Shortly after we left, a whistle blew. The shots rang from a machine gun located on the Standpipe Hill near my residence, and aeroplanes began to fly over us, in some instances very low to the ground. A cry was heard from the women saying, "Look out for the aeroplanes. They are shooting upon us." The shots continued to be fired in rapid succession from high-powered guns from the vicinity of the hill. We continued to flee until we were about 2 miles northeast of the city. There we tarried at the home of a friend. Shortly, the fire broke out. The bullets continued to whistle. The fire grew rapidly. We saw it spreading over our entire district south of the hill. About 10 o'clock, men came out in cars and told us the troops had come. Shortly afterwards, we saw men dressed as soldiers in automobiles rounding up the people and asking them to go back, that they were safe. And on our return, my wife and niece were told to go up Greenwood Street, and I was searched and told to go in another direction to Convention Hall, where I was marched with hands up and hat off. I was searched with hands up by two or three different sets of officers. I reached Convention Hall about 10:30. On the way to Convention Hall, possibly 30 minutes after the troops came, there was only one small fire north of the hill. But on the next day, when I viewed the devastated area, there were hundreds of homes burned after the troops had rounded up the men and taken them to Convention Hall. I remained at the Convention Hall until I was released and sent with a Red Cross worker and the county physician to the Morningside Hospital to assist in treating the wounded in company with the county physician. I came by my home to see if it was destroyed and to get my medicine cases. On reaching the house, I saw my piano and all my elegant furniture piled in the street. My safe had been broken open, all of the money stolen, also my silverware, cut glass, all of the family clothing and everything of value had been removed, even my family Bible. My electric light fixtures were broken. All the window lights and glass in the doors were broken. The dishes that were not stolen were broken. The floors were covered, literally speaking, with glass. Even the phone was torn from the wall. In the basement, we gathered two tubs of broken glass from off the floor. My car was stolen and most of my large rugs were taken. I lost 17 houses that paid me an average of over $425 per month. I worked heroically for the Red Cross, and being the assistant county physician, my work was doubly hard. For the first 3 days, I did not stop to clean up my house, save moving my furniture onto the porch. I worked extremely hard for 3 or 4 days after the riot. I almost collapsed. We slept out at the fairgrounds, the first night without any bed, on the hard floor. Spent the next night or two at the schoolhouse. Then we came home and slept in the house with the doors broken and the window lights out. In the meantime, I was assigned to a sanitarium where the slightly wounded were treated. I dressed a number of cases without any assistance. In the meantime, answering a number of calls out in city for the Red Cross. About the fourth night after the riot, I received a call to go to the fairgrounds where a large number of Negro refugees were assembled. My wife, being nervous and suffering other infirmities as a result of the riot, urged me to stay with her as she was seriously sick. I asked to be excused, as I had already made 2 calls that same evening. The next night, I was asked to go to the fairgrounds. Not having sufficiently recovered my strength and doing heavy work during the day, I asked them to see if they could not get another doctor in my stead. So they found one. I continued to work at the sanitarium for the slightly wounded, and also treated cases in the city. To my surprise, about a week or 10 days later, I saw statements in the paper that I refused to work with the Red Cross without pay, and the White Medical Association voted to discontinue an allowance of $25 per week for the above reason. A day before this, however, I was given the credit of leading a riot 2 years ago, going up to the police station and demanding to see if a certain prisoner was safe who was threatened to be lynched. Of this occurrence, I knew nothing at the time it happened until the next morning, and for 2 years after this, said event occurred. Although many were quite familiar with it, my name was never mentioned. It seems that several things have been said and done to discredit and kill the influence of the men who have large holdings in this burned district. By Dr. R. T. Bridgewater, Assistant County Physician. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 22, 1921. 14 years in Tulsa. In these years, I have noticed a growing racial hate by the lower whites because of Negro prosperity and independence. Also, a racial hatred because of Negro rooming house porters, whom they claim associated with white women in these places. Of this hate, yellow journalism was mostly responsible in promoting. Next, lacks law enforcement by both county and city. The lawless element of both races were so arrogant until it was dangerous for the best citizens to make much protest. The Chalk joint evil being of the worst type of breeding places for lawlessness, where white and colored of their kind met and socialized. These forces reached the place of unrestraint, broke loose on a pretense, and thus swept down upon the good citizen with all the hate and revenge that has been smoldering for years. So the innocent suffered most, who thought little of their homes being burned. Most people, like myself, stayed in their homes, expecting momentarily to be given protection by the home guards or state troops. But instead of protection by the home guards, they, the home guards, joined in with the hoodlums in shooting in good citizens' homes. This was my experience. So, after seeing no protection from them, I took my family and a few friends in my car and drove 4 miles into the country, where we were gathered up by state troops, who were perfect gentlemen, and treated us like citizens of real America. By E. A. Loop, Plumber. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 23, 1921. About 9:30 on the night of Tuesday, May 31, 1921, I heard the report of guns and thought it a fire signal. Then I found out what the trouble was. I became tangled up with the walls of my bedroom, and after getting straightened out, I went to the door, saw people rushing to and fro. I called to a man and asked what the trouble was, and finally my neighbor told me that the white people were going to lynch a man. I dressed the little girl who was with me at this time and went to a neighbor, stayed there until about 1 o'clock, and then returned home. I tried to sleep but could not, so arose about 4:30 Wednesday a.m. and saw people rushing from Greenwood and that section of the town. A group of whites, stationed on the hill, fired upon them, some falling, others struggling on to safety. Then it dawned upon me of the danger of my invalid mother, who had been helpless for 4 years. She was about 6 blocks from me, up in the direction from which people were fleeing. I reached her house in the midst of a rain of bullets. My sisters and I gathered her up, placed her on a cot, and 3 of us carried the cot, and the other one carried a bundle of clothes. Thus, we carried mother about 6 blocks, with bullets falling on all sides. About 6 squads of rioters overtook us, asked for men and guns, made us hold up our hands. There were boys in the bunch from about 10 years upward, all armed with guns. They would go into the houses, take what they wanted, and then burn the house. Our men were all disarmed as soon as caught. About 11 o'clock, the enemy took my invalid mother and one of my sisters, supposedly to send them to Convention Hall for safety. Another sister and I scouted about until 1 o'clock, when along came a truck and picked me up and carried me to Convention Hall, where I stayed until about 2 o'clock. On entering Convention Hall, I failed to find my mother, so I went in search for her. With the aid of the Red Cross, I found her that night at the North Methodist Church. I made myself contented until Thursday and came out to see if I had a home. Out of 3 houses that had brought me $45 per month rent, I found one little rickety shack. After finding it, I returned for my mother, kept her until Sunday morning, and in the meantime, I tried to get a pass to send her away, but failed to get one. So I took what little change I had left and sent her away. She remained unconscious for 2 weeks and then passed away. When we were trying to take her to safety, an airplane shot down a man right in our path. I feel that this damnable affair has ruined us all. By Mrs. Carrie Kinlaw. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 23, 1921. On the night of the riot, I was living at 623 Hill Street. My wife was sick, having been confined only 3 days. She was under the care of Dr. Jackson, who was to have called the next morning at 8 o'clock. I heard the firing all night. In the early morning, the whites began firing on my house, so I had to try to find a place of safety to take my wife. When I returned, my children had taken her to a neighbor's home. By that time, they were looting and burning my home. We had 2 large trunks which they took into the street and burst open, took what they wanted, and set fire to the rest. The rest of my family, with my wife, made it to the soldiers for protection. She was so sick that she fainted. They had me surrounded, so I got a water barrel, rolled it into an orchard of peach trees, and hid in it until the storm passed over. I lost about $2,500 worth of property. By J.P. Hughes. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 24, 1921. I was living on Williams Street and was at home on the night of the 31st. I went on the street and met about seven women running for refuge from Archer and Greenwood Streets and that section of the town. I watched over them at my home throughout the night. When morning came and the firing started, they again ran for safety, leaving my wife, three children, a baby, two elder children, and myself. I continued to watch over my family until about 8 o'clock a.m., when the two elder children, a girl and boy, fled northward for safety, leaving my wife, baby, and me. My wife not being well, I remained at home amid the shower of bullets from the hill. We opened the house, raised the curtains and shades, and stayed in sight as near as possible amid the bullets. We would appear on the porch. To the best of my ability, I kept all males from the house. Then a bunch of whites came down from the hill. My wife and I ventured out amidst the volley of fire, met them about a block from home, and told them that my wife was sick and I did not want to leave her. They had me to raise my hands and searched me. I was bareheaded. One did not want me to even get my hat, but my wife threw it to me. The lieutenant who was leading them assured me that my wife and baby would be safe and that my home would not be molested. Then I was marched to the top of the Brickyard Hill, and there I was called all kinds of names by boys from 10 years to men of 60. Then I was loaded on a truck and carried to the corner of Boulder and Brady Streets, and here I was taken off the truck and searched again, cursed, called all kinds of names in the language of take your hats off, throw up your hands, be submissive, and obey to the letter. Even boys of 10. I obeyed. After entering Convention Hall, I met with very courteous treatment because I was well known among the better class of whites. In the meantime, my wife and I were separated. They took her and baby to the park, she being sick. I was in a fit of eagerness to find her, so I phoned the man by whom I was employed, and he came and got me released, took me in a truck, and went in search of my wife. At the baseball park, I found that my daughter had fallen into an epileptic fit and was sent to a hospital. In a frenzy of despair, my task had just begun. But by the help of the godsend Red Cross, answering my wants as far as first aid to the body, but no satisfaction of the mind. I found my wife and baby safe at the Fifth Street Methodist Church. If we had had complete cooperation from the officers of Tulsa, they could have prevented all this disaster and not used the occasion to demoralize our business industries and our nice homes. But instead of protection, it was seemingly a matter of destroy and abolish all Negro business and nice residences. By A.J. Newman. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 24, 1921. On Tuesday evening, we heard the shooting and several friends came to my home for shelter until about 2 o'clock. Then in the early morning, the whites were stationed on the hill with machine guns and high-powered rifles, firing upon our people as they tried to run for safety. About 7 o'clock, the whites or home guards came for the men. Then they took the women and children, promising them safety. After they had the homes vacated, one bunch of whites would come in and loot. Even women with shopping bags would come in, open drawers, take every kind of finery from clothing to silverware and jewelry. Men were carrying out the furniture, cursing as they did so, saying, "These damn Negroes have better things than lots of white people." I stayed until my home was caught on fire, then I ran to the hillside, where there were throngs of white people, women, men, and children, even babies, watching and taking snapshots of the proceedings of the mob. Some remarked that the city ought to be sued for selling damn niggers' property so close to the city. One woman noticed the First Baptist Church, which is a beautiful structure, located near a white residence district. She said, "Yonder is a nigger church. Why ain't they burning it?" The reply was, "It's in a white district." I saw an old colored man, Mr. Oliver, who stayed with Dr. Jackson. I hailed him and asked him to help me with my handbag. He told me that Dr. Jackson was killed with his hands up. He said that ruffians ordered him out of his beautiful home. He came out with his hands up and said, "Here I am, boys, don't shoot." But they shot him just the same. About this time, some home guards appeared and ordered Mr. Oliver to come to them. While doing so, a bunch of rifles were raised to shoot. The guards fell down, and Mr. Oliver took shelter behind a post just in time to save his life. Then Mr. Oliver went to the guards, and they searched him, with hands up, and took over $50 from him, which they failed to return, and they took him to Convention Hall. Then the horde of ruffians went down on Detroit, looting those beautiful homes of everything valuable, and then burned them, even breaking the phones from the walls. The machine guns just shattered the walls of the homes. The fire department came out and protected the white homes on the west side of Detroit Street, while on the east side of the street, men with torches and women with shopping bags continued their looting and burning of Negro homes, while aeroplanes flew overhead, some very low. I watched this awful destruction from where I sat on the hillside. As I sat watching my modern 10-room and basement home burn to ashes, an old white man came by. Addressing me as Auntie, he said, "It's awful, ain't it?" and offered me a dollar to buy my dinner with. Name withheld by request. Still awake? If you'd like to hear more of Events of the Tulsa Disaster, just search Audible or iTunes or Amazon for the Kindle and print editions. I'll put links in the episode description. And again, please follow, subscribe, give 5 stars, or let me know in any way that you enjoyed your trip.